Can hear you, Daddy.
Okay,
Blog
don't have
Talk Radio.
Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio, creating waves of awareness over the airwaves, via the internet, and by friends telling friends they care, working in unity to promote homeopathy around the globe. Join us on Monday evenings, U.S. Eastern Time, as we explore homeopathy and facial analysis, a show co-hosted by HWC founder and homeopath Debbie Brook and Grant Bentley, homeopath and naturopath. We invite you to comment and call in to contribute your questions. Let's go!
Welcome to Homeopathy World Community. This is Debbie Brook speaking with our co-host, Grant Bentley, Australian homeopath and specialist in the facial analysis method. Today is January 30th, 2012. We're coming to the end of the first month of the year. And whether you're new to homeopathy or just continuing your lifelong study, you will find this information innovative and an addition to your healing toolbox. I myself am planning to sign up for the upcoming course being given, and we're going to learn more about that during the show. And we request that people share these shows either on Twitter by sending a tweet, clicking the tweet button right there on the main page, sending it in an email, putting it on your Facebook, sharing it on StumbleUpon, Dig, or any other of the social networks. We have done quite a few of these shows and learning a lot. Grant, we're going to be continuing on with the themes that you started last week.
Yeah, I just thought that what I'd do, Debbie, is talk a little bit more about using mentals as life themes. What we have generally is that the mentals are generally kind of really used in an emotional sense rather than anything else, when in fact a lot of the time, particularly Kent, who was one of the major advocates of the mentals, often described that the emotions were perhaps a little lower down on the order of the scale of repertorization. I always think that, and I stress this to every one of the students that I have, that you really do need to understand how to repertorize properly. I repertorize every single case. I've been doing homeopathy almost exclusively now for close on 20 years, and I repertorize still every single case. Whether I think that that case is obvious or not, I still do a quick repertorization. Once you get good at it, I mean, it only takes you 5 or 10 minutes to do a repertorization anyway. If you know how to use it properly, one of the things that we found in India was that often they would talk about how it took them so long to choose their rubrics, and that repertorization was a long and sometimes arduous process. But it actually shouldn't be. It really is something that you can do quickly. And it takes out all the guesswork. I think, you know, back when Kent was around, I can understand why essence prescribing took off. You know, for anyone that has ever trained in pen and paper repertorization, it's an incredibly laborious task. I like to get students to do at least one or two full paper repertorizations so they can get the process of how a case is broken down after case-taking and then rebuilt to produce a remedy at the end. And I think that it's a very kind of organic part of being a homeopath. It's a very organic, constructive process that is better understood if you just do it by pen and paper. But, of course, you can't practice by pen and paper. But homeopaths, even in the past, didn't practice that way either. I know everyone was meant to, but the simple fact of the matter is that it would take you, if you're going to spend an hour or and a half with each new patient if we're talking about constitutional prescribing. Then it might take exactly the same again to do the repertorization, another, you know, few minutes to select the remedy. And so in the end, you'd do two patients a day and your whole day would almost be filled. So when we hear of practitioners that are treating, you know, 10, 20, 30, 50 patients a day, and then we're getting into others that are doing outpatient clinics where you're seeing 100 a day, well, there's absolutely no way, one, that full constitutional prescribing can really be done with all the mentals included. And two, I suppose, that it really couldn't be done with a pen and paper repertorization. So as a result of that, repertorization kind of faded out a little bit, and a couple of different techniques came in and took its place. One of those techniques, which is still around, in fact, both of these techniques are still around and still being used fairly frequently, and one of them is either the PQRS prescriber or keynote prescribing. So it's just looking for one or two keynotes and then prescribing on that basis. Now, of course, anybody that is going to be seeing, as we were talking about in India, anyone that's going to be seeing 100 outpatients a day is going to be doing keynote prescribing. You can't sit down and ask patients, well, you know, tell me all about yourself. All you can do is say to people, you know, tell me about your complaint and try and get it in the same way as a Western GP would do it. The second method that came as well as the keynote prescribing was, of course, the essence prescribing. And this came because that people would take their best guess at what they considered the remedy to be, or they'd do a very quick repertorization and it would fail. And as a result of that, there had to be a theory to explain why these well-indicated remedies weren't working. And what developed from there was the concept that perhaps that there is a hidden inner core, a personality of a remedy that's not being grasped by the dry, more blunt facts and figures that are provided by the repertory, and that will be found in the Materia Medica. So though both of those processes seem to develop and then have been passed on down to us. What we find, though, is that now, particularly with Western homeopathy, the vast emphasis is on the mentals. But the mentals, if we look at Kent, who's kind of the really biggest advocate for this, I understand that Hahnemann in the Organon does talk about how the mentals provide the most important characteristic to unlock the remedy. He definitely does say that. So I'm not suggesting that it's un-Hahnemannian, but what I am suggesting is that the amount of time and effort and the amount of aphorisms that Hahnemann actually spent writing about the importance of the mentals is very, very limited by comparison to, say, posology of the new way of prescribing, the need for the repeated dose, and also to understanding the miasms in chronic disease. So while there might be one or two aphorisms denoting the importance of the mentals, there are, you know, 50, 60 aphorisms, even more perhaps, regarding chronic disease or repeated dose. So we can see by the sheer weight of volume that while Hahnemann thought that it was important, he didn't see it as the be-all and end-all, because this was a guy who was pretty used to emphasizing and repeating his point. That's one of the problems the Western mind has with the Organon is that it is repetitive. So the fact that he doesn't repeat it anywhere near to the same degree, to me, tells me the degree of importance that Hahnemann placed on this. Kent, on the other hand, has a huge importance. When you read books like Kent's lectures on homeopathic philosophy, even the very first chapter, which I think is called The Stick, he goes through, and essentially the bottom line is that you've got to understand the person that is sick rather than what sickness that person has. And we have taken that Kentian philosophy on. And I'm not saying it's necessarily wrong, but what I'm saying is that we've taken it down an avenue that perhaps is not necessarily what Hahnemann meant. Hahnemann meant the demeanor and the change of the mentals of a person. When Hahnemann talks about the mentals, he talks about the change in character. Often what we talk about when we are doing this post-Kentian type of essence prescribing is that we are talking about the actual character, not the change in character. And that provides a very big difference, because particularly when it comes to case-taking and the mentals and life themes and so on, what you're looking at there is that a normally placid person who now becomes very critical means that the rubric censorious is now thrown into the mix. Now, that's the Hahnemannian view, and it's an important rubric because it is a deviation away from normal. Whereas what we've kind of taken Kent to be and developed upon Kent is that if we understand the person in their entirety and we almost repertorize on that entirety, so they're in their entire character, then we'll begin to be able to select the right remedy. So it's one is character in its normalcy, its day-to-day life, and the other one is more the aberrant or the change of character due to the sickness. In Kent's two lesser writings, I think it is, being unprepared here, I might be a little wrong, but there is a chapter called Why is Cancer Incurable? And in that chapter, you can see there, that's a perfect demonstration of what I'm trying to say about the difference between Hahnemann and Kent when it comes to the mentals, because Kent is very much, you need to understand the person from the moment that they were born, pretty much, to the diagnosis of the cancer and everything in between. And once you have a remedy that fits that picture, meaning this sort of very contemporary, this is the Nat Foss person, this is a Calc Carb person, that is the Kentian way. Whereas that is slightly different from Hahnemann, where the placid person who turns censorious, or a fearless person that is now anxious. So what they would do is that Hahnemann would put in the anxiety rather than understand the complexity of character and personality. So kind of trying to come to terms with this and really understand a different way of prescribing. And I guess if I had have spoken to you maybe 10, 12 years ago, I think you would have been speaking to quite a different practicing type of homeopath. I would have been very much of this post-Kentian ilk, particularly going down that personality pictures, you know, the Lycopodium picture, the Arsenicum picture, and also to embracing a lot of this sensation method as well. I ended up, unfortunately, now this is just my experience, but so I'm not suggesting anything about the method itself, but I unfortunately have to give a lot of these methods away because I found that my success rate fell by trying to incorporate these methods in. I kind of moved into the labyrinth of understanding the person in their entirety and almost forgot a little bit to remember the basics, just like modalities and so on. But look, that's another story. I ended up giving a lot of that away because my clinic just simply couldn't afford the indulgence of me doing it. And so I stop those kind of auxiliary methods of understanding or psychoanalyzing character, And I just went back to the basic Hahnemannian Bonninghausen, you know, back to the generals and so on. But at the same time, it's important to realize that the mentals, and very much so, and this is, and Hahnemann places a lot more emphasis on this than even the mentals, and that is causation. Causation of where that patient is now. Now, this is where I guess I am going with life themes, because essentially what life themes are is that they are a causation. And that causation generally in chronic disease, and what I call non-infectious chronic disease, because there are in fact two types of chronic disease. So what I'll just call non-infectious chronic disease, I am looking for the causation. And often that causation will be found in the repertory, in the mental section of the repertory, because what we're looking at now is that we are looking at an ongoing stress or a stressor that is so profound that they have never been well since. Now, never been well since stressor can take a number of different forms. It can take a physical form, like an accident, a car accident, which is so clearly obvious if it does real physical and psychological damage. But also, too, the loss of a business or the death of a partner, where a person has not got back into their former self, or they have been able to eventually return to the person that they once were, but at a huge energetic cost to themselves. I don't think that it's any surprise that within 18 months after the death of a loved one, that often people will, and this is with a long-term relationship, often the survivor will start suffering serious emotional or physical consequences. You can't, as homeopaths, we understand, and even the conventional medicine, they get this too, but they don't know what to do about it. I mean, apart from antidepressants, what do you do about it? And this is where homeopathy becomes absolutely vital. That homeopathy has this incredible ability to be able to get into the very essence, that spirit, that energy of that sufferer, and be able to do something about it.
Can I? Sure, of course you can. Okay. Well, I feel like we're getting the before and after Grant. From before what you did and how you practiced and how you saw things, and now this is the after. Maybe the idea of the causation is because you weren't getting enough successes in your clinic. But
no doubt about it.
Right.
Yeah, no doubt about it. I just wasn't.
Right. So I guess I wanted to get a little example of what you're saying. You're saying that, let's say, a causation, and there are a lot of people who have a loss, a death of a loved one, and we know there's a pretty high percentage of the partner who's left, they don't live that much longer quite often. So something has happened by that loss. Now, would you say that there is a set number of homeopathic remedies that would be this causation because there was a loss, and that makes it easier for you to select the remedy?
I think that any appropriate homeopathic remedy can do that job. And this is moving away, I guess, from almost the emotional speciality that essence does. Now, and this has been a huge leap for me, because essence prescribing is all about, well, look, if the person suffers a loss and they become hysterical, it's Ignatia. If they suffer a loss and they become reserved and withdrawn, it's Natma, and so on and so on.
Right.
And so what we have is that we actually pigeonhole these different remedies. So we have the basic grouping of grief and loss. But then we also have these subgroupings of where you are under the category of grief and loss. What I've realized is that any remedy, you can choose aconite, you can choose calc carb, you can choose lachesis or veratrum, and it will deal with the problems that that person has if that veratrum is selected via two categories. One, it's selected according to the facial analysis. That is absolutely vital. The second one is that it is selected in accordance to totality. So we were speaking once when we were saying about how I was giving calc carb to a person who was tall and, you know, twinkly-eyed and all these things after phosphorus didn't work. And so then I saw the calc carb did work. And what reminded me of was Hahnemann's drugs for many people and for many uses. This is what the Polycrest is. But what I understand is so many of our homeopathic drugs are, in fact, nearly every one of them is a Polycrest if it's used appropriately. We don't have to go searching for thousands and thousands of emotional specifics. That defeats the whole purpose of totality. So what we know is that we, and this is where I guess this is the pre and the post. The pre practitioner that you would have been talking to 12 years ago was far more Kentian, post-Kentian, Sankaran, the whole thing. What I am now is much more Hahnemannian in the sense that I look for either a causation with the inclusion of the change of the mental state. So, for example, if I've got somebody in front of me and we'll just take the death of a loved one as the primary cause here and just sticking with that same pattern, then what we have is that I would include that into the repertorization. What I was doing in the past was that I was trying to whittle that down because I was thinking to myself, this is miles too broad. I need to understand how that patient is responding in their absolute core to the death, right? So grief is too broad. Anger with grief is too broad, and so on and so on. But now I don't do that at all. What I do is that I think the broad is good. Look, when you're doing a pen and paper repertorization, you cut it down, you keynote, because if you look up depression and there's 800 remedies and then you start, you know, aconite one, you just work your way through. It's going to take you 2 hours to do that. But we don't have that excuse when we've got computer repertorization where it takes 2 seconds to drag and drop an 800 remedy rubric. And we can narrow that down by a Bonninghausen method. So what I would do is that I would go into the mental section, and I will go into the death. And it doesn't have to be a fear of death if the person isn't fearful of it, but I will take the presentment of death and I will drag and drop. And there is my causation. Now what I will do, if there has been a fundamental change in that person's emotional or mental state, meaning let's just make something up here. Let's just say that the person was a very precise, a very intelligent, and a very sharp sort of person. Now, after the death of their partner, let's just say it's a wife, the partner that died is the wife, so we're dealing with a man here. He's a precise, fairly intellectual sort of guy, but what he's found is that since his energy has dropped and life has become grey rather than colourful after the death of his partner that added all this colour, then what we see is that he will start complaining about how he can't concentrate and he's becoming very forgetful. And, you know, I was usually right on the ball. Now I'll go down and do the shopping and I can't find my list and I can't remember anything. Now what I will do is I don't try and necessarily understand the emotion that's causing all this. I just do the Hahnemanian instructions of taking what you see at face value. So now I have two rubrics. I have the death, and now I have the forgetful. And both I just drag and drop into my selection, and then after that, I will try and look for a couple of generals. So if the person hasn't been sleeping well or they're waking up in the middle of the night, then I go back to the normal pattern. You want a who, what, where, how, why of every time there is a problem. And I find out that the person is waking around about 3 o'clock. So I go into the generals. I go into, in some computers it could be under the sleep, but you go into the waking after midnight, 3 a.m., drag, drop, okay. Then I go into things like food preferences. Does your energy drop at any particular time during the day? A whole range of things, because what I'm after is that I have causation, I have mental or emotional effect, but what I don't have, if I don't have generals, is that I don't have how my patient's body is trying to reestablish an order. Remember how we were talking, and this is where the series starts kind of, we've introduced a lot of concepts into blocks, but now what we see is that those concepts are beginning to become a unified system of practice. Because what we spoke about before, about the generals, is that in seeing homeopathy as an almost infinity of energy. So we see it going around in this horizontal figure of eight, and what we see here is that we go into things like law of motion that Newton put down, all of these laws that help us understand how energy works. And we know that to every cause, there's an equal and opposite effect. So there's action and reaction. So in the death, we have the cause or the action. But we know that there's going to be a counterbalance. I don't go anymore, and I don't subscribe into the whole idea. What a constitutional is for me is understanding the sum total of cause and effect. Not psychoanalyzing my patient or finding out at a deeper level who they are than they even know themselves. That's not my job. That person's come in to see me for whatever complaint has arisen since this cataclysmic moment in their life, and that's what I have every intention of doing. So my job now is to understand, after I've got the cause, in this case it's fairly obvious, the death, I have the mental, and now I need to understand the general physical reaction to that cause. And the best way of doing it is through the generals. So even if this person wasn't forgetful and they still remain sharp, then what I might have in my repertorization is that I have death, I have the waking at 3, let's just say their joints are beginning to play up, so I just go into the extremities, I do joint pain, I drag and I drop. They have a sudden craving for sweets, which they never used to have, which would probably be explained because of their energy drop due to their loss. And there's a number of ways that you can explain these things away, but the point is that they exist and they were changes from that moment. And so all of the collection of these generals together with the cause becomes my repertorization. The only difference when I talk about a life theme is that a life theme is an ongoing process rather than a ground zero. A ground zero is kind of like the death. It's a never been well since moment. But the majority of people who suffer from non-infectious chronic diseases don't have a never-been-well-since moment. What generally happens is that there is a series of events that that patient is specifically tuned into. They are very sensitive to. And often they are made sensitive by the fact that these events have taken a toll so consistently on them, a little bit like the beekeeper who's just had one sting too many, and all of a sudden, you know, every sting sends them into hospital. Often what you'll see is a continuing trend or a cycle that is going through this patient's life. Now, we have a philosophy that you know, it's a saying that what doesn't kill you only makes you stronger. It's just not true. I mean, with a lot of people, what doesn't kill you will certainly make you weaker, and the next time it occurs, it'll make you even weaker still. Some people are very sensitive to certain things. Let's just take violence, for example. If somebody is born into a family where that family, there is, let's just say, a dominating father, and it doesn't even have to be physical violence. Let's just say there's a dominating father who is putting that this child down. This time we can, we'll also make it a male, but this father's putting this male down and telling him he's no good, he's worthless, blah, blah, blah. Then what happens, we find that later on in his life, he gets into a job where there is either a dominating boss, or we find that there is a very critical and dominating wife or partner. So what we have now is we've got this guy walks into our office. He's just been diagnosed with cancer. He's in his mid-30s or perhaps 40. He's also on high blood pressure medication. He's on anti-anxiety tablets, and his joints are giving him a hell of a time, and they're doing tests for rheumatoid arthritis at the moment. So what we see here in front of us is a body that is completely drained and burned out. It has been trying to keep itself afloat for a long period of time against overwhelming, cascading odds that are running it down day after day. And when we go through this person's biography, we see this criticism all the way through their lives, and they can't escape it. When we look at every other aspect of their life, they enjoy their children, they enjoy their work, or they like the actual job, even though it may not be the boss that they like. They got bullied at school, they feel like they're being picked on, not listened to at home, and so on. So now what we see is that the cause of the complaint is not a never-been-well-since moment, but a series of events and struggles that has carried on from this person's life for perhaps 40 years to a point where their body can now no longer supply the extra energy that's required by the continual drain of the criticism. Because when you get run down, when somebody else steals your energy, you need to put that energy back into your body from somewhere. Now, the only somewhere energetically that we have is the somewhere of tomorrow. So we borrow from tomorrow's energy supply, a bit like half the Western world's credit. We borrow from tomorrow's energy supply, but eventually tomorrow becomes today. And that's when that patient ends up in your clinic. There's no infectious disease. There's no syphilis or psychosis or anything like this. And there is no never-been-well-since critical ground zero moment. It is a series of energy drains that has put them into the seat opposite your desk. And that series of energy drains is what I call a life theme, a repeating pattern that that is running this person down. So that life theme now becomes the cause, and often that's taken from the mentals. So it could be, in this particular case, I would take the censorious or the criticized, and I might even take the dictatorial, and I will drop those two into my repertorization. There we have our cause, our energy drain. Now what I do is that I get the sum total of the generals, and I include that into my two causations, and I have my constitutional repertorization. I don't know everything about this person. I don't know what they aspire to, and I don't know every nuance or shade that makes them who they are. But I don't have to. My job is just simply to try and rebuild their health. And the way that I do that is through Hahnemannian totality, not through post-Kantian psychoanalysis. And one of the major changes that I've had to make is in the understanding of mentals as causations and as life themes.
That was a very good explanation for my simple question. On the chat, we have a couple of people listening in. My question was, does everyone have the never been well since? And you answered that very thoroughly. So I'm hearing also that, you know, whether the cause was continually being criticized, could it also be that the person growing up has been criticized, or the people in his family have been critical, but then when he goes out on his own, that factor is still not there, but in his own mind he hears it? So even though...
Yes.
Okay, go ahead.
No, I understand exactly what you're saying. And this is what I mean. You become sensitized to it a little bit. So you begin to... Every one of us has these aspects of our character that we are very, very sensitive to. Now, we could have been born that way, or we could have been made that way. But either way, that doesn't matter, providing I understand it. Because what I am trying to do as the practitioner is that I need to... The person that's sitting in front of me is a chain. They're a chain of circumstances, thoughts, emotions, events, and a whole range of other things. Now, for that chain to be strong, I need to find its weak links. So I don't need to understand the whole character of the chain. I don't need to know how long the chain goes for. I don't need to understand what the chain is made of or where that chain is going to be used in 10 years' time. I only need to know where that chain's weak links are. And the remedy fixes those weak links. It builds a bridge. It kind of solders them together. But at the same time, always understand that soldering job is not as strong as a chain, as a link that hasn't been broken. So while we, with our remedies, can solder these weak links back, it doesn't take much for them to be broken again. And this is why I think that Hahnemann, in the end, and this is a completely different story, but this is why Hahnemann started going down the LMs and the importance of the repeated dose, because he realized that even though the semillimum was good, the people need a lot more than just one dose to pick themselves up when they're talking about a chronic disease. That's a story for another time, but it's when you're coming to deal with life themes, it's about making that mental shift back away from this post-Kantian sort of psychoanalysis and into the Hahnemann prior cause. And when you get that, then we can use the mentals, and it becomes very obvious. We only have to sit back and listen to this person's life story.
Grant, In a way, you said, I'm using a metaphor of this boy growing up has been in this family being criticized, almost like constantly hammering a nail into a piece of wood or something. You know, they're constantly getting this push into them until they're in such a weakened state they can't pull themselves out. You said, you know, pull yourself up by your bootstraps, kid. So, you know, they don't have the energy to do that. So this is, and I'm interested to learn more about how you give the remedy, but to just in the same way that it was constantly pushed until he was belittled, now you have to keep giving the remedy on a daily basis to move that energy up.
Yeah, that's perfect. And that is exactly what Hahnemann found too. And this is why he spends so much time in writing. And this is the last book of his life. We can tell what is preoccupying his mind right at the... He's got 50 years of or 30 years of experience here, all wrapped up into this sixth edition. And what preoccupies his mind is this. One is understanding how to treat chronic disease, and two is trying to come up with a way that you can do the repeated dose, because repeated doses are necessary. They are the two major things. If you break all of the sixth edition down, they are the two things that Hahnemann is stressing. And he is stressing it for exactly the same reason as what you said, because that's what cause and effect is. It took a long time to get here, drip, drip, drip. And so if we think we're going to go in there with 1-200 and suddenly everything's rosy, you can forget it. We have to build up what has been broken down. And that's why the repeated dose. The question of how do you find this never been well since. I mean, the never been well since rubric can be anything. It can be, like we were saying, if it's death, then you would do the presentment of death. If it was a car accident, then you would go into the generals and you'd do the injuries. So actually, the never been well since is often more easier to find than the constant drip, drip, drip. And just in finishing this, and this is maybe a topic for another time, but what we find is that it's not only that you become sensitized to this, like what you were saying, that, you know, you become sensitive so you start seeing it everywhere. The real ironic twist of this is that we begin to attract people into our lives that will do and the very thing that we are a little nervous of. There is a real reason why that happens, and that's to do with our energy and body language and all sorts of things. But maybe if we talk about that another time.
Okay, so the one moment that you paused, Grant, I had it on mute. So,
oh, right. Okay.
Well, what I did was I extended the time so that we could answer any questions. If anybody in the chat had any questions, let's see. Someone said something in here. Let's see. I think that we're fortunate that Louise, your partner, is in the chat when answering questions for us, if anybody has them. And she answered something in here. How would never well since event be repertorized? Well, we'll probably have to go into something like that on the next show. But I think that you were explaining that... Living Goody, who came in late. I think if you listen and to the repeat in the archive of this show, just download the podcast onto your cell phone or to your computer, then you can hear this show or any of the previous shows that Grant has been doing. And also, I wanted to next week we're going to do clinical prescribing. So that will be interesting. And I want to let people know that we have more shows during the week. On Wednesday morning, Dr. Otto, cardiologist, will be doing a show on heart health and homeopathy. He's talked about a variety of things, everything from diabetes, thyroid disease, and exercise for your health. And on Thursday at noon is Alan Phillips, attorney at law, talking about the issues of vaccinations and how it affects and probably does stress us, and what you can do legally in terms of waivers and exemptions. Following Alan at 1 o'clock on Thursday is Dr. Christina Chambreau, doctor of veterinary medicine, and she's going to be doing a case study about a terrier who has colitis and itchy skin. So that's going to be really interesting. So, Grant, thank you so much for getting on. It was a terrific show. I hung on every word, listening very closely to see if I could learn more from you. And why don't you tell folks about your upcoming classes, so that if anybody wants to sign on, to go to www.vcch.org. I think that's it.
Yes, that is it, and we have short courses. We have a whole range of things available. There are longer courses to try and train people into this way of case taking and how to do it. That will be beginning around about March, all of it online training, and all of them with recorded classes as well as live classes, so you're free to join in with the classroom or to watch it where it's more convenient. There are short courses that we have starting in February. We also have cases that you can buy where we will run you through the start to finish of a whole range of a whole series of cases, so you can see the case taking. We break down and give the repertorization, we give the facial analysis, we give the description of why we're giving the remedy, and most importantly, we always give follow-ups as well. So there are a whole range of things that are available, so please take a look at the website.
Okay, we're going to end the show, and thank you so much for listening to Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio.
Thank you for listening to Homeopathy and Facial Analysis on Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio with homeopaths Debbie Bruck and Grant Bentley. We encourage you to follow our show. Click the reminder button to receive email notices when shows air. Share with friends on Facebook and MySpace and also Twitter. We welcome your comments and questions. See you next time.